You're listening to episode 80 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? I'm really excited to share that we're in the middle of setting up an online shop for 88 Cups of Tea. We're working hard at making sure that whatever we offer will add tremendous value to your storytelling process. We're also going to have some fun 88 Cups of Tea swag available in our online shop. But for now, we set up a temporary page for those of you who'd love to support our show and rock your limited edition 88 Cups of Tea mug signed by yours truly. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/mug for more info. Thank you so much in advance for showing your love and supporting our show. On to the next part of our intro. If you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with fellow writers, or if you'd like to submit questions for future guests on our show, you'll love our group. You'll also get sneak peeks of our publishing calendar for future episodes. And for my craft-focused writers, there's some pretty awesome advice being passed around in our group, and not to mention the amount of love, support, and encouragement that's shared in our community. And by the way, we just recently decided that we'll be mixing in some live Facebook videos. We receive a lot of packages from publicists pitching authors for our show, and this will be a really fun way for you to watch me unbox new books from authors we may potentially invite on the show. So if you love those kinds of videos, be sure to join us over at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there. Now on to our show. I'm so excited to have Quarterly sponsor today's episode. They're the only book subscription curated by authors just for readers like you, as you'll learn in today's episode with the amazing Beth Revis, who BT Dubs was the very first curator for Quarterly's Young Adult Fiction Box. The curator leaves post-it notes with annotations throughout the entirety of their new book. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out who their Young Adult Fiction curator for the new Quarterly box is and learn about the exclusive special just for our 88 Cups of Tea community.
Beth is a New York Times bestselling author, most widely recognized for her book series Across the Universe, which was selected as a teen top 10 novel by the Young Adult Library Services Association and was long listed for the Carnegie Medal and featured as a book of the month from 17 Magazine. Her latest title, A World Without You, is a semi-autobiographical novel that follows a teen named Beau, who suffers from mental illness, and his sister Phoebe, who struggles to come to terms with what Beau's illness means for her. In A World Without You, Beth guides us through a complex look at loss and grief through a lens of mental illness. It's a must-read that reminds readers about hope and that they're not alone. For Star Wars fans, Lucasfilm tapped Beth to write the backstory of Jyn Erso in her newest book, Rebel Rising, releasing in May. For those of you who watched Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, the movie hinted at a divided relationship between Jyn and Saw Gerrera. In Beth's book, she walks us through how Jyn's childhood in the care of Saw affected how we see her in the movie after the death of her mother and the disappearance of her father. In today's episode, we dive right into how she drew inspiration from her career as a teacher for her book series, Across the Universe. We also take a closer look at the inspiration behind A World Without You. We discuss how being a part of online writing communities can instill confidence and self-validation for your writing. And we explore how to cope with the far too common mindset of not feeling like we're good enough and moving past that imposter syndrome as a writer. For listeners who are all about getting down and dirty with the technical topics, you're going to love Beth's writing tips. We dive into her research methods for crafting science fiction novels and how to write strong background characters. She guides us in approaching emotional scenes that are difficult to get through and step-by-step advice on the world-building process. Beth even jumps in with tips for writing unreliable characters, how to send out query letters, and earning income while pursuing your art. Now let's jump right in. Hey everyone, we have Beth Revis with us today. I know a lot of you are really excited about having Beth on the show, and I am too. Beth, how are you today?
I am fine. Thank you so much for having me.
We are so excited to have you on. How did you first fall in love with storytelling?
Oh, I love that question. I think I've always been in love with storytelling. I have a picture of myself in first grade with a coloring sheet that I wrote a story to go with it. And I think that's the first time that I really was like, oh, a story I can tell. I still very distinctly remember it. There was a unicorn and a dragon, and it was awesome. And then I wrote my first novel when I was in elementary school for the girl that sat beside me on the bus.
What?
Okay, I say novel, but it was 5 pages long, but I thought a page a chapter.
That's awesome.
So I was very, very impressed with myself. And my friend was like, oh, you're the author. I loved that part of it. I didn't think I could make a career of it for a very, very long time. And now that this is my life, it really is literally like a dream come true.
I'm super curious. Why did you write it for the girl next to you in the bus? Is it because she was a really good friend?
This makes me sound way more noble. No, it's actually because we live way, way, way out in the country and our bus ride was almost an hour long. So we would just get really, really bored.
That's amazing though. I bet you had some beautiful scenery driving by the entire hour long ride. That's so awesome.
Oh no, but as every country girl would attest, it was not entertaining. Sure, it was pretty, but at the time I was just like, I hate this bus.
I think for me, because I'm from New York, I'd be like, yes, nap time. Yes. I'd be so excited.
The morning bus ride was always about sleep. Definitely. The bus came at 5:30 in the morning.
What?
We had to be ready by 5:30 or so or 6 in middle school and high school and get on the bus and just be there forever.
I know right now you're living in North Carolina.
Yes.
So you are also a native from North Carolina?
Yes. Very rural in the foothills of the Appalachians.
I really want to go visit North Carolina. I heard it's beautiful and you guys have some amazing hiking spots, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, if you're somebody who's not like me and never gets off the couch, it's great.
You're awesome. We got to hang out. That's so amazing because I think for me, that's kind of something that I'm gravitating towards now that I'm older. It sounds so peaceful and stress-free. I feel like we would be able to live longer living here in North Carolina. But, you know, grass is always greener on the other side.
Yes. Oh, we got plenty of grass. Not necessarily a good Wi-Fi connection, but plenty of the grass.
I will take that over good Wi-Fi any day. I need to make a trip out to your side one of these days in the near future because that sounds gorgeous. I also would love to know, when you mentioned you didn't know that it could be a career to be an author, I think a lot of writers feel that too, where it's just, wait, what? That's possible? I thought these books were kind of magically appeared. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's how it worked for me.
We also have a lot of people telling us, get a real job, get a real degree.
All the time. Even when I did book stuff and I did work on things, I had family members saying, okay, so when are you going to get a real job? I'm like, wait, I just finished filming a feature film. Just give me a few months, please. Yeah. Don't disown me yet. One second. And I feel that I hear the same thing from authors. They could have something published already. And they're like, okay, well, where can I find it? Barnes & Noble? Oh, it's not Barnes & Noble? Then when are you going to get a real job? Or if it's in Barnes & Noble, they're like, oh, you must be making millions.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an extreme on one end or the other end, and they don't really realize the realities of being a writer, and they keep throwing that whole 9-to-5 job in our faces, which is pretty tough. Did your family encourage you to have a 9-to-5 job, or were they super supportive about your writing?
I think my family's main concern was that I have a degree that I could fall back on. And so they really pushed me towards education. They never quite discouraged me from writing, but they also never felt like it could be something I could make money on. Which, to be fair, is a really difficult thing to make money off of. Yeah. So they pushed me towards the education and towards having a degree. And they were always very supportive and encouraging of what I did make. I think they also felt good when I had a 9-to-5 for a while and did not quit that job until I was able to make money on it.
Do you mind sharing with the listeners what degree that was? And also, I know that you were a former teacher and how that led from there to teaching.
The degree was in English education, and I went on and got a master's in English literature so that I could teach at a college level if I ever needed to. And then I was a public school teacher for 6 years. And during that time, I wrote my first novel when I was a sophomore in college. And wow. I wrote a novel a year for 10 years before anything got published.
Dang! Yes. That is amazing.
When I first got that teaching job, I rolled in on the orientation day because we had to do like a week of training before we started. I was a little rude. I was like, I'm not here to make friends. I'm going to quit as soon as the novel takes off. 6 years later, I'm still doing it.
Teaching there, I'm sure you drew a lot of inspiration too from observing the student and their lifestyle. Is there anything that you can share with us where you did draw some pretty good inspiration from your teaching times for your stories?
It still influences me to this day because I still keep in touch with a lot of my former students. Very specifically, Across the Universe came from working in that area because, like I said, I went to a rural high school when I was a kid, and where I taught was even more rural and more out in the country. Even though there was lots of wide open fields and open spaces, if you didn't have a car or money, you were really trapped in that area. There was really nowhere to go and nothing to do. And so that sense of entrapment led to Across the Universe, which is about being trapped on a spaceship. A little bit more specifically, I had this one kid in one of my classes. His name was Ben. And I know we all know somebody like Ben in our real life because Ben never, ever shut up. Ever. I know this because one time I put him in the corner for talking and he talked to the wall.
Oh my God. Are you serious?
Absolutely. And I had him for two class periods in a row. So I had him 3 hours a day. And at the end of one very long day with Ben, I was working on Across the Universe after school. And Across the Universe is essentially a murder mystery in space. And I needed my first dead body. I killed Ben for like a whole chapter and it was glorious and wonderful. It was really the best thing ever. I enjoyed it so much.
That was the best story ever. Talk about sweet revenge.
I had to tell him when the book was published. I was like, hey, I killed you for a chapter in this book and it's going to be published.
Man, I bet he was proud.
Oh, he was so proud. He has it on like his Facebook profile. It was so proud. And ever since then, I still have former students contacting me on Facebook. They'll come to my events and like, will you kill me in your book next?
Man, you are probably the coolest teacher. No joke. Everyone's like, yep, she taught me. That's right. You know.
I was also super strict because I was notorious for having a very, very difficult final exam. I mean, that thing was huge. But I got my first book deal and the final deadline for my book was the exact same day that grades for final exams were due. That year, I gave all the kids a 5-question test. And the first question was, what is your favorite color?
Are you serious?
2 + 2 = what? Because I had to give a final exam, but I knew I couldn't grade anything well. And I had former students who had taken the real final exam, like, give me the dirtiest looks for the rest of the semester. How could you have done that for them?
That is amazing. I can just hear students, if they're listening in, it's like, oh my gosh, I hope my teacher has a due date of a fully published book by the same date of my final exam so I can have those kind of questions too. Where did you get your teaching style? Because you said you're pretty strict with your final exam.
I like to think that I had that attitude, but I also was just really passionate about the subject. And so I'm a fangirl of Star Wars and Doctor Who and stuff like that, but I'm also a fangirl of world literature. And so I would just really get involved in everything. And I wanted them to know it too. I didn't grade that much. I prided myself on not giving them busy work or anything, but I expected them to pay attention when I was teaching. And I learned that, especially after my first year, which was a little bit disastrous, that a lot of the kids really wanted structure and they wanted an education and they just wanted someone to be passionate about it. And that passion kind of bled through, or at least I hope it did.
I'm sure it did. Are you kidding? I think it's rare to find teachers with that much passion. At least for me, some of the teachers growing up and friends, teachers, I think maybe they were just exhausted to a point where they gave up on their passion. And I really am a firm believer in whatever job you have, I don't care what you're doing, be passionate. Love what you're doing. Yesterday, I was going to the post office and I met this guy named Marty who works there, this older gentleman, and he was just so passionate about his job and so helpful and just put a smile on my face. And he had this whole Long Island, New York accent going on. And he came off a little, I wouldn't say brash, but a bit tough. But you can tell there's so much love there. And he was just going through and weighing different things for me to find out, like, different ways to find the cheapest way to get a product out there. And you would think, you know, just doing daily things, just going to the post office or going to get your groceries, you don't think much about it. But my God, yesterday, that experience with Marty, I was just, whoa, he is so amazing. And he just reminded me why everyone needs to be passionate about what they're doing. It doesn't matter what you're doing, but you got to have a lot of love. You're going to spread that love and joy to other people. And that sounds like what you did as a teacher. And I think that's really cool.
I wish I had teachers like you back in the day. Jeez, that could inspire me. You know what would be cool? I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of your students ended up wanting to write books as well.
There's actually a few. I'm having a conversation with one of my former students. And I also wrote a series of self-help books for writing, publishing, and marketing. And she got all of them and she's read all of them. And she's asked me so many adorable like follow-up questions. I really hope you make it. I told her I wanted her to sign a copy of her book to me whenever she became published.
You must be so proud because you know you are the inspiration for that, for her wanting to be like you, basically. That's phenomenal. You deserve a huge congrats for that. I think anytime adults stir up any kind of passion or inspiration from teenagers is like a big deal. So huge kudos to you because I have two younger sisters who just passed their teenage years and trust, it gets tough. You did not know that being an author could even be a career. So just to tap on that, when was that moment, if you remember, when you realized, hey, this could be a job?
I'm laughing because this story is so disgusting.
Oh my God, I gotta hear it. Tell us.
I was teaching when I got the agent offer and then I got the book deal and all of that happened while I was still teaching. And I literally finished Across the Universe the same week that I turned in my resignation and finished the semester and said I wasn't coming back the next year. And it didn't really hit me until I very distinctly remember I was sitting in the school's parking lot when I was accepting the book deal and was like, okay, yes, I'm going to do this. This is going to be it. I drove all the way home. And I got out of my car. My husband's waiting for me. He's like, oh, we should go out and have dinner to celebrate. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm quite up to going out. Let's just get takeout. He went out and got takeout. And then somewhere that night, it really hit me. This is my life. The dream I've been working for a decade is coming true. And so I threw up everywhere. I gave myself stress-induced gastroenteritis.
Oh, no.
Had to rush me to the ER. I was given 2 morphine drips, not 1, but 2 morphine drips. I spent a night in the hospital, and the whole time I just remember crying. I was like, my dreams are coming true, and now I'm gonna die.
I adore you. You are the most awesome person in the world. That is an amazing story. Beth, you cracked me up. That is so funny. Were you okay, though, after that?
It took me like another day to like get over it. And of course, all my friends at the school, the other teachers, they were like, oh yeah, you got good news and you partied too hard. And I was like, no, I swear that's not it.
Do you remember the dinner that you were having?
It was General Tso's chicken. I still really like it. So at least that's going for me.
Oh my God, I literally have a tear in my eye. I'm lifting up my glasses, wiping that tear away. I would say the closest thing coming into that is before every audition or almost every audition that I was super excited about, I would have IBS. I would have to run to the restroom right before my audition. I would get so nervous, TMI, but I knew that if I had IBS, I knew it was a good thing because that means I love this role. So let's
go. No, I have since learned that whenever I have like extreme happiness, I just throw up, which is not really a good reaction, but at least it means I'm really, really happy.
Can you imagine us in the same room being super excited? It's just both ends. We're covering it both. Don't worry, guys.
Let's hope the janitor of the bathroom really loves his job and has a passion for cleaning.
Leading into your first book, Across the Universe, I know that you said it was inspired by you when you were teaching and the area you were in, and it kind of felt like in a way it was trapped, so it's like a spaceship. But Across the Universe, was that the first book that you wrote where you had in mind, I want this out in the world?
I had been writing full-length novels then for a decade, and every single one of those I thought was good enough. And as I was working on them, I was like, this is it. This is going to be the one that breaks through. And when I wrote the first one, I was 17 or 18 years old. And at the time I was like, oh, I'm going to be this child prodigy and J.K. Rowling will invite me to tea. And this will be awesome. Amazing. I submitted every single one of those 10 novels to be published because as I was working on them, I always thought that they were the one. Each one felt like the one. And then I would send it out and the agents would come back and be like, oh no, this is not the one. Try again. I always thought it was the one. And Across the Universe, I don't think it felt different until I got to the end. I have a very distinct memory of leaning back in my spinny chair because writers deserve spinny chairs. And I was leaning back in this chair and I very distinctly remember, this is the best thing I have ever done. And I cannot write anything better than that. And if this doesn't make it, I should quit. That was the one that did make it, and it did change everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are any of those books that you wrote each year, have you revisited any of them? And then now you can have a different perspective, especially you said with Across the Universe, the ending was different. So now you kind of walk into this whole storytelling process with a different point of view. Do you think there's any of the ones that didn't make it through that you could pull out and revise so that you can give it another shot again with your new perspective?
There's one of them that I think may be worthwhile. It's the one that my mother really likes. I mean, in general, they really kind of suck. And it's just that I couldn't tell it at the time. I thought I was really, really amazing, and then realized as time and practice and experience went on, I realized, no, I was really a bad writer then. I needed that work.
Did you throw yourself into writing workshops? I know you're super busy teaching.
Yeah, I did several conferences, especially in the summertime, because, you know, teachers have the summer off, which is not always true, but I was always able to carve out a week or two there. I did that, and I joined SCBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and I was able to hook up online with some people like that, and I joined a lot of online communities, and they all really helped me, and I was able to form some friendships and get critique partners who we swap stories with, and I'm still friends with several of the people that I did that with. Throwing yourself into the community, I think, is always a good thing, especially, as we said before, like, not everybody looks at writing as something that could be a viable career. So if you join a community where a bunch of other people are trying to make it their viable career, it gives you your own sense of self of validity and reminds you of what you're doing and what you're aiming for. It's always really important to, not just for the instructional and the education, but to join the community and join other people.
I absolutely agree. I'm sure your community rose up from years and years of going through all of this. I guess you could say the quote unquote, the slog of rejection letters and then downtimes. Did you keep in contact with them when you were going through downtimes to like talk about it? That's the thing about community, is where you can reach out to each other, right? And just talk about the hard times that you're going through. And I think that makes a huge difference, not just knowing that everyone around you is wanting to do the same as you, but also knowing that, hey, I'm not the only one that's feeling like crap right now.
Yeah, there are a few people. And then it does get hard later on when one person would have success and somebody else wouldn't.
That's
and a lot
true.
Of times, like in a year or two, the other person would also have success, but that didn't always happen. I felt that on both ends. Somebody in my critique group got a book deal 2 years before I got a book deal. And there was that sense of wonder and joy and happiness, but also deep, intense, burning jealousy. And I can do that well. I have those deep emotions. I'm part German. I know. I was published a few years before some of my other friends were published, and I kind of felt them and their frustration. And there's a little bit of distance because there's different things to take joy in and to complain about when you move up the ladder, so to speak. So it's a difficult thing, but I think it also teaches you just how to be human and how to deal with that feeling.
I love that you're talking about that, learning how to be a human, acknowledging those emotions. That reminds me too of insecurities and fears. Were there any major insecurities that you had either growing up or recently blaring in your head?
I don't cope. I think I've always had the feeling of not being good enough and this desire for validity for what you do, especially in the arts where it's not 2 + 2 = 4. There's not a clear answer of whether or not something is good or bad. And there's always somebody critiquing, not necessarily just critique partners or editors, but there's book reviews. And there's always somebody who will go, oh yeah, this is my favorite book, or oh, I can stand that book and I threw it against the wall. That feeling of being good enough is something that I think drove me a lot to be published and then continues to be a source of angst and vodka.
My choice is gin, but okay. We could definitely hang out. And this is something I'm always curious about too, just talking to friends and wine and cheese night with my best friends and chatting and even talking about it with my grandpa, who's an artist, is that whole idea of, oh gosh, I'm not good enough. Where does that come from? If we remember one moment that triggered that, and it always leads back to some time when we were younger, like elementary school, whether it's a teacher that said something and just totally shattered our confidence, or it's our own parents who maybe their upbringing was a bit different with their own parents, grandparents raising them. And I know especially with most, I can't say all, but at least mine was mostly like the Asian culture and how my grandparents raised my mom, well, how my grandpa raised my mom and how my mom raised me. So there was sometimes that fear and insecurity of me never being enough. I think that can have such a tremendous impact, whether it's for the better or for the worse. It sounds like not all the time, but most of the time it's for the better because it pushes you. Do you think yours was drawn from upbringing or in how you were raised? Or was it maybe a teacher in school that maybe shaped you in a certain way where it's, okay, you want to prove yourself that you can do this?
I think some of it probably comes from the fact that my parents were both very hands-on, worky type jobs. They both were in the lumber industry. I like to joke that my dad's literally a lumberjack and he reads my cute little romance stories anyway. So there's a little element of that. When they did a job, you saw it done. You saw it completed. Whereas in any art, It's often hard to figure out when something is done, when you have tweaked it and edited it and perfected enough to be called done and put the end on the end of it. I think there's a little bit of that. And then there's a little bit of the fact that my brother growing up, he was an artist. He drew. He had what I call like true natural talent. In high school, he would just doodle on the side of his page and it would be better than most professional artists could do.
He had,
he never had to work for it. And I was always very bitter about that. He's the kind of guy, he didn't need an eraser on the end of his pencil.
Ugh, one of those.
Yeah, I mean, he could just close his eyes and draw a perfect circle. It was crazy. And he had the vision to see things in a different way. And it was very natural to him. Like I said, it took me 10 years to even get something that could be published. It was something I had to work for. And there were many times when I wondered, is it futile to work for it? Is there something that you have to be born with that I don't have? And so there was definitely a little bit of element of that. And I had experienced that before. I used to take piano. I loved it, but I did not have the inherent love of music that at the recitals, you could pick the students who felt the music in their blood. And I could just read the music notes and push the keys in the right order. And there's a difference there. And so I definitely felt it with music that I did not have that. And I always worried that I didn't have it with writing either.
Wow, that was pretty deep. That was really deep. I can see that. And that's what I think about for music too, because I also grew up learning piano as well. And I was like you, where you could give me notes and I'll just do it. I never had that kind of passion until it clicked one day where I was listening to this song. It was by OneRepublic, Apologize. And there was this pianist on YouTube who just like blew up. He was self-made and he turns all of these hip-hop songs into piano songs of his own interpretation. And that was the first time where I truly understood passion for what it is that you're doing in a musical aspect in a way that translated to me that I could understand. And then that's when I tried and I was able to finally get the passion out. I don't know how, because I never thought I was able to. I was almost like robotic, you know, like before that. And then just watching someone else and being so inspired by that person, his passion totally was passed on to me and I just soaked it up like a sponge. In that moment, I do absolutely believe there are people who can have this God-given talent. It's not something that most people can work toward, no matter how hard you work. It just shows it's really about the work ethic and the passion. Trust, I know a lot of very talented people, born brilliant. Their work ethic is totally obliterated. It's almost like laziness that kicks in because a lot of them take it for granted. In the end, it's like as if they were never born with anything and didn't do anything with it.
There's a value in failure that I think people often ignore and forget, because failure teaches us not to give up, for one thing, if we really care about it, but it also teaches us to deal with art later on, because there are always problems and there's always issues. And how do we deal with it? And how do we find the confidence in our art? And we learn that from failure. And without having that failure, you can't sustain a long-term career.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Talking about failure, I would love for you to walk us through the most difficult time in your life. And please walk us through that moment and how you were able to get past it.
Actually, I was recently talking to somebody about this because she felt like she had imposter syndrome. And she was like, when does this feeling of being an imposter go away? And I realized that I don't have imposter syndrome as much as I used to anymore. And I think it was because the worst possible thing could happen happened and I lived through it. This was after Across the Universe, which was the book that like made my dreams come true, which sounds so cheesy, but it's
no,
true.
No, it's true.
It was a phenomenal success. And in terms, because my publisher really supported it and it hit the New York Times bestsellers list. It helped me go on book tours. It really changed everything. And then the thing I wrote after it, nobody wanted. My agent didn't want it. My publisher didn't want it. Like nobody wanted it. And I was like, well, I tried for 10 years before I wrote a book that anyone wanted. I really don't want to spend another 10 years writing to get another thing that anybody would want. Having that rejection all over again, it was almost like a PTSD. You thought you were hot and you were doing well, but just kidding, you're back down in the slumps. And having that rejection, it broke me for a while. And it definitely messed with my confidence. And it messed with my idea that I could do anything, because I kind of had this idea in my head, once you have success, you're out of the trenches. You don't have to have the rejections anymore. And that's really, really not true. And so having that happen again, but then continuing through and continuing past that to more books published, to more deals, to deals that I'd never even dreamed I could get, like getting a Star Wars gig, having that downtime proved to me that I could go through it and I could survive it again.
You got that on point. And you were saying earlier, you just had this conversation with someone recently. Yeah. About imposter syndrome. That's funny, because that's a question that a lot of people in this podcasting community do bring up, about imposter syndrome. So thank you for sharing that.
To survive imposter syndrome, just fail a whole lot.
I mean, it's true though. It's absolutely true. Because then also, when those successes do come, imagine on the flip side too, it's like how much more grateful we'd be as well. This is not something easy peasy that just drops in our lap. This is something that we worked our asses off for. When it does happen, when we get back up again, it's like, hell yeah, time to celebrate.
Yeah, and you have the confidence to hold on and not let go.
I know you also mentioned about how Across the Universe did change a lot of things for you. In those moments, do you remember, man, like what was that most exciting moment for you when you first got the news that it's like selling so well? Or was it more so that it got published, officially seeing it and picking it up at a bookstore, and it's a tangible object that you can feel and touch and smell?
If you had asked me closer to when it had happened, I probably would have picked one of those, either seeing it on a shelf or having the launch party or something like that. But now that it's been out for a few years and time has moved on and my memories get kind of fuzzy with it, the thing I remember the most is the first fan letter I got. Oh. And I still very distinctly recall it, because it was a girl from Greece. And my first initial reaction was like, how did a girl from Greece get my book? But it was a very, very personal letter, and the book had helped her escape a hard time.
Oh, wow.
And I still remember that moment of reading that letter. So that one-on-one interaction is the thing that stays with me.
Wow, that is incredible. Congratulations on that. That deserves a huge congrats. Look at you inspiring all these young readers all around the world. That's amazing.
The next thing I got in the mail after that was a hate letter. So it all evens out.
Excuse me. Yeah. What are you talking about? What kind of hate letter is this? That's BS. What?
It was somebody who was in the publishing industry, so I won't name any names.
Oh, hell no.
He felt my science was very incorrect on something. And I was like, yes, because that is a clue for the second book. He was very vociferously against the science in my science fiction.
He can move along. My gosh. How did you get all the details about the science fiction part? Did you do a lot of research?
I always went as far as I could with what we had currently. So I would research, for example, the first chapter of Across the Universe, the girls being cryogenically frozen. And so I researched why we don't have that now. And the reason why we don't have it now is because we basically get freezer burned and our cells pop. So once I realized like why we don't have it, I could just invent something to make it work. So I invented a blue goo that prevents that from happening. And so everybody can be frozen. And so a lot of the research, it really was just a matter of finding out why we don't have the thing I need in the story, and then inventing a way to make it work, which makes my job a lot easier than actual science, because that has to follow rules.
Yes, that's genius. How long does your research process take normally?
That's a really hard question for me to answer, because I actually just really enjoy it. So it's not like in school when you had to study for something. It's more like, oh, I really enjoy this. I want to find out more and I'm curious. And a lot of times I'll follow the rabbit trail of question after question and continue on. So it's fun reading.
I want to bring it back a little bit more to fiction growing up, just trying to see why you lean towards science fiction and where is it like that inspiration, where that came from. Was there a fiction that you fell in love with growing up that you still remember that made the biggest impact on you and you were like, holy shit, this changed my world?
Yeah, absolutely. It was the Chronicles of Narnia, and it was a fantasy novel. And I very distinctly recall the library that I used to go to had a staircase, and the children's section was in the lower section of the library. And much like Harry Potter, I hid underneath the staircase and I read those books. And I very distinctly recall, I've realized now that it's an obvious allegory and you really like, it's really like in your face. But at the time when I was a little kid, I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, what if Aslan is Jesus? And like, At the time, I thought I was this wonderful Indiana Jones explorer who had delved into the book and discovered a unique theory. I realize now I was not as genius as I thought I was.
Listen, you're way more genius than a lot more people. I mean, hello, when I read it, I fell in love with it, but saw no Jesus references at all.
It took me, like, I had read this book many, many, many times. So it took a long time for me to actually get this. And then I was like, whoa, it blew my mind.
I still see it as you're pretty genius. Oh, wow. So that was the book that changed your whole life.
That would have a huge impact, yeah.
You have a dog named after a Harry Potter character. Yes. So I'm assuming you fell in love with Harry Potter as well?
Yeah, Harry Potter did have an influence on me. Those books came out when I was in college. And I was with my college roommate in a Barnes & Noble once. And we were there to pick up our very literary complete works of Shakespeare. We were being the college kids. We were like, oh, yes, we're here for our literature. And I remember after we had gotten these massive volumes, we were walking through the store and my roommate goes, you know, sometimes I like the books over there. And it was said like almost like this was a dirty little secret. And she was pointing to the YA section. And I was like, yeah, sometimes I like books that aren't written by dead white guys, too. And it was this awe-inspiring moment that I could read something other than what was on my class list. And very soon after that, I got into the Harry Potter books. And they reminded me that something can be entertaining and also have meaning to it. Mm. That was something that I did not see that in the college atmosphere. In the college atmosphere, it was very much Chaucer knows best. J.K. Rowling knows best, too, because she can put in a toilet joke and also make you think about the importance of family at the same time.
Yes.
And that was a big step for me. I think that's the reason I write YA.
I am pretty sure J.K. Rowling will invite you to tea one day. And you guys are going to hang out and you're going to tell her person to person, eye to eye, how much she changed your life and your whole perspective of fiction and young adult fiction. So I know that day will come.
I did have a chance to meet her once.
You did?
Yes, it was when Casual Vacancy came out and I had some friends who got me tickets to one of her signings. And I was with a friend of mine and my friend's entire job was to make sure I did not throw up on J.K. Rowling. We have a picture of it. And there's a little schoolgirl me like, hi, J.K. Rowling. And I'm like shaking. And in the background, you can see my friend in a spotter position, ready to dive forward and take one for the team if I upchuck.
Is this a friend that's also a writer?
Yeah, it is. It's Victoria Schwab.
I didn't have Victoria Schwab on the show, but I had another author on the show. And they were talking about not wanting to throw up as well on J.K. Rowling. And I was like, wait a minute. Are you the friend that she's talking about? Oh my gosh.
I think not throwing up on J.K. Rowling is a goal of a lot of people.
I know. I was like, it sounds pretty common, you know? Like if I were J.K. Rowling, I'd walk around with like a rain jacket just in case and an umbrella.
I think she should consider it. Yeah. I mean, she had bodyguards on either side of her, but they were not prepared for the real danger.
Okay, the next signing that she has, you just have to slip in your business card and just like pass it to her with your phone number and be like, hey, let's go to tea. All right, bye. Right after I throw up on you, exactly. And Beth, if you don't mind, can I throw in three listener questions? Because I know they're super excited about it. So the three that we selected, first one is from Alyssa Coleman. So Alyssa says, I'm so excited for Beth's episode. I would love to learn more about her world building. Her books are so rich with detail. I'm curious about how she plans in advance, how much she discovers as she writes. Also, does she have any tools she could recommend to others creating sci-fi worlds?
Oh, that's excellent. And it makes me sound way smarter than I am.
Excuse me. No. Don't be too humble now. You are brilliant.
No. I don't plan anything. I don't know what I'm doing. I just make it up as I go and hope nobody calls me on it.
Damn it. Talk about making everybody else jealous. Thanks a lot.
My best advice for role building is make sure that you make it dirty. I think a lot of times, and I see this more with fantasy and sci-fi than other genres, but make sure that your world is just not pristine. Make it dirty and really lived in. For example, when I was writing Across the Universe, I would make there be rust and scratches on the walls and discarded things that you don't really necessarily know what they're for. And then when you're rewriting, because if you're like me, you have to rewrite the thing 800 million times. When you're rewriting, you remember those little details and then they can become clues for something larger. So if you have a dent in the wall, you can later tell a story about how that dent got there or how that dent later caved in and made the wall crumble or something like that. But whenever you're writing the world, just make it really, really dirty and lived in and scratched up and not pristine. The only one I think who can get away with this is Tolkien when he wrote the elves. Like, their world is all perfect and beautiful and blah. But I also really don't like Tolkien. So this is where my philosophy is coming in. Make it really dirty. Blade Runner has a much better cinematography. New Zealand's pretty, but come on, it's just pretty. Blade Runner has a more interesting background and a more interesting world than The Lord of the Rings. Fight me.
Oh, snap. Girl, go cause a war. Bring it. Thank you so much for answering. That was beautifully answered. And also Alyssa asked an amazing question too. Our second listener is Vanessa Andrew. She'd also love to know more about how you incorporate creating and growing ancillary characters in your worlds. How do you find the right way to exaggerate these characters' traits in such colorful environments? As always, tips on developing character voice, she's asking.
For ancillary characters and background characters, I think the most important thing is to remember that they're the hero of their own story. And so if you approach it with, if I shift my perspective, I could tell my book about that character instead, you'll have a really good, strong background character already. And then to emphasize those voices and make them even more unique, just make sure that they have opinions. Make sure that they, anything they do, they're not just doing it because the story needs them to do it. They're doing it because they want to or need to, or they're not doing it because they don't want to or don't need to, so that they have some clear motivation. One thing I like to think through, I don't actually outline or plan or anything, but one of the things I always think about is, what does the character want and love? And I usually try to make those things butt heads with each other. They want something, but they love something else and they can't have both. And then I also try to think about what the character fears. And you would think that hate is the opposite of love, but it's not. It's fear. And if you think about what your characters fear, what they don't want to have happen, or other fears in that sort of thing, not like spiders, but they don't want to be alone or whatever that may be. If you think of their fears, you'll really figure out who they are as a character.
Damn. Oh, we are so lucky you are also a teacher. I don't even know how you remembered all the questions that I threw at you.
You are so good for my ego.
You are such an amazing speaker. Truly, you need to go around speaking if you don't already.
This is all thanks to the coffee. I would like to credit coffee for all of my success.
By the way, before we go on to the third question, what kind of coffee do you like?
My trick with coffee is I like the sweet girly drinks. I'm the whitest of white girls on this one. However, I would say if you add a pinch of salt to your coffee, it makes it so, so good. So whatever kind of coffee you want, just put like a little pinch of salt in it.
That's kind of like butterscotch when you think about it. It has like a nice, sweet, salty taste. I'm a huge foodie, so I just love anything eating and drinking. I'm like, yes, yes, tell me more. Moving on to the third question from our third listener. It's from Gwyn Jackson. And Gwyn would love to know how you take on the challenges and rewards of writing unreliable narrators. Also, the science of your science fiction is so compelling. She would also love to know how you create it so effectively.
In reference to the second question, I know a few people who don't think my science is that great. With unreliable narrators, I actually really, really super love that as a trait. As you can tell, in Across the Universe, I have an unreliable narrator, and A World Without You, the entire premise is based on an unreliable narrator. In the entire book, you know from the start, he is not a reliable narrator, not because he's a liar, but he has difficulties perceiving what's real and what's not. I love that. And I think the reason why I love that is I don't consider these characters to be liars. I know in Across the Universe, one character lied by omission, and I don't want to give away any spoilers. There's a little bit of a lie by omission there. I consider them to be characters who did not intend harm with their unreliableness. In A World Without You, there's a mental illness going on, so it's truly not a malicious thing. In Across the Universe, the same thing applies. The character who was unreliable was not intending anything bad to come from it. I love that sort of balance between trying to be good and failing at it. And then also the idea of not really knowing the truth or not, because I think in a lot of times things are true or they're not, but then there's also an element of gray area. And the gray area is where I find my best stories. in the next book I'm writing that's going to come out in 2018, it's about right and wrong. It's not about an unreliable narrator, but that right and wrong, it's about the middle space in the middle where you're not really sure what is right and what is wrong. And that's the thing I love about the stories. Not necessarily the unreliableness, the gray area where real and not real and right and wrong mix together and fall apart.
Okay, so I'm going to throw this question at you. What was your hardest scene to write?
So the hardest thing for me to write came from A World Without You, my most recent novel that came out last year, because it was a very personal story. And I didn't intend for it to be a very personal story. I much prefer blowing shit up in space. And this book is not that kind of a book. It's a story about a boy who believes he has the power to go back in time and that he's attending a school for superheroes, except that school for superheroes is actually a school for mentally challenged youth and people who have mental health issues. Originally, it was going to be the Memento knockoff, if you've seen that movie.
Memento is so freaking good.
It's really good, yeah. And a little bit of Shutter Island and that sort of sea kind of thing. Those are the things I love. And so that's what I wanted to explore. And then in edits, it was my editor who pushed me to make this a more personal story. And she kept saying, you know, this needs another perspective. And so I had to rewrite the whole book and add in the sister character. And the sister character now has about 25% of the narration or so. It was all of her scenes that were the hardest, most excruciating things to write because they came directly from my life. Growing up, the brother I was telling you about who was the artist, he had a mental illness and it was a mental illness that ultimately killed him. Going back into those memories and talking about that aspect that was really true. And I know I was just talking about what's true and what's not, but those were true to my life. And going through that was a really excruciatingly hard thing to do.
This brother, because I actually was going to ask if what does he do now, as in like, you know, his art is, you know, he's just so talented. I am so sorry about that. Was it only you two in the family?
Yeah, it was just us two.
Oh, wow. You're younger.
No, he's older.
He's older. Oh, man. When did that happen? Was it in your college years?
A senior in college, yeah.
I know quite a few people with chronic depression, and also I was diagnosed with depression as well, and I understand it's an ongoing thing that you just kind of learn to live with. Also, I have people close to me that are bipolar. Was this mental illness specifically anything that I mentioned?
Yeah, he was bipolar and had manic depression, and then there was probably a few undiagnosed things as well.
Me knowing a few people in my life with bipolar, I have difficulty bringing it up because seeing them as a different person. I see them as a whole person. When you do family members and the support system around them recognizes anything that points towards bipolar, it is important to bring it up and have those important conversations of how you can get from one point to another point. Were you struggling with that? Or did he recognize it himself?
It was always a struggle. And it was partly a struggle just in terms of diagnosis and how to treat it. It went a long time without having a proper diagnosis, which made it worse. But then that also made it more difficult to talk to, because I see this a lot in mental illness, not just in my own case, but in situations with other people, like when I was working in the school system and things like that. Mental illness is an invisible disease. It's not like a broken arm. You can't see that someone's ill. And sometimes they try to hide it, or sometimes the family wants to hide it from society. Anytime that happens, it becomes a boiling pot and it doesn't work out. I don't think this was a book I could have written after it had immediately happened. It took a decade or more of time to separate before I could really go back into it.
It was obviously a very emotional process. How did you unwind yourself? So when you're exposing yourself with moments like this and memories like this, how did you unreel yourself back so that you kind of close that wound again, you put that bandage over? Or was it something that after writing, it almost added to the healing process?
It did help the healing process for sure. But the other reason why I don't think I could have written this book at any other time in my life is when I started writing it, I found out I was pregnant with my firstborn child. I turned the book in on Friday and gave birth on Monday. That's how close that was.
What?
And that, yeah, I had a very real deadline with that book. My editor was like, oh, take your time. I was like, no, this baby's coming. Yeah, there's time to be had. In a lot of ways, it was not just that the time of distance since my brother's death that enabled me to write it. It was the fact that I was growing new life, which sounds weird to say, but the feeling of life goes on, and here is the perfect literal example of that really enabled me to just to move on. And I had realized I had a lot of fears about my brother's mental illness being passed on to my son. But once my son was there, I realized like that was not a fear anymore. And it was partly because I had written a story looking through my brother's eyes, and that gave me a new perspective of it. And then it was partly just looking into my newborn son's eyes and realizing that life was more than this one definition of this one person in this one moment of time.
Beth, you are such a beautiful speaker, as always. Is there one thing that you can pass on to listeners who do have family members or themselves, they think that they might have a mental illness or might be struggling with it?
I think the most important thing I can say is that you're not alone, because growing up, I definitely felt this was the family secret, and it was never spelled out like that. It's not this is the secret, but it felt like a secret. It felt like something I couldn't talk about. It felt like something that I didn't want to advertise. And that's one of the reasons why in the book, one of the girls is invisible, because it's the superhero connection with the story. But at the moment of time in my life when that was happening, I felt very invisible. It was like I could not show my true self and I could not show my true feelings. I think that's the most important thing, is that you're not alone, and that there are people who see you and see what you're going through, and that you can reach out if you need to.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. When I was trying to figure out how I can be there as a support and making sure that I don't, because a lot of times I felt like I was saying the wrong thing and then it would be taken the wrong way, or there are moments, especially episodic moments, where if they're going through episodes, you just have to be really careful what you say, but also being firm and letting them know that your love is going to be there no matter what, and your support is going to be there no matter what. So I actually found this online resource. I think it's the National Alliance of Mental Illness or something, NAMI. And my gosh, they had some really fantastic resources, and they even have support groups for the caregivers of the family members or friends with bipolar to be there for them and to know how to take care of themselves. Also, just showing up, knowing that, you know, you give it your all at the same time. And the things that you mentioned just now too were mentioned in the resources and articles that NAMI mentioned as well, that organization. So thank you for that. I think that is really important. I know that this podcast is about storytellers and about writing, but to be real, writers, storytellers, it's all a part of life. It's all about observing life. You know, that's what writers are known to do. And in order to create our work that is honest and truthful, you know, in whatever way we see, it means seeing us as whole human beings and others around us too. Along with everything that you've gone through, and also there's lows of lows, but there's also high of high moments. And you have so many opportunities, and we were talking about, for example, your very first book, you were already like on tour and everything. What are other super exciting things that have happened?
I do quite enjoy staying at home without pants on. The best thing about writing is meeting readers, and I love book tours. I love meeting readers. I love just talking books in general. I love diving into new stories. Like you said, that's the thing that authors love to do. The high highs, there's more of those than the low lows. There definitely is. And you just never know. With this career, you never know what's going to happen the next day. And some great opportunities can land in your lap. Now, right, I have a Star Wars book coming out in May. And that was something that I never, ever thought would happen. And seeing that I'm now part of something that I used to love so much as a child, and now I'm in it. I'm in the bones of Star Wars. And
that's so crazy. Can you walk us through that? Like, I don't even know how that even works. Also noticed, for example, Cammie Garcia, we had on the show recently, she wrote the X-Files, like their younger version, and then Leigh Bardugo, she was writing for Wonder Woman. How on earth does that work? Because you have to get the rights from the actual company, right?
No, I consider this having hit the publishing lottery, the jackpot. Lucasfilm's publishing contacted my agent and asked if I would be interested. And my agent asked me, and I promptly freaked the F out.
And wait, you barfed first, though, right?
Very nearly. When I had to fly out to the offices and talk to the head people at Star Wars, I didn't eat that day. And I knew this was an issue. And I was like, not eating. And San Francisco is famous for their Asian food. And I was like, oh, it looks so good. Nope, not going to eat any of it.
Got it.
When I was finally flying back home, I was in the airport. And I was just eating everything in sight because I was so hungry. But it was like hitting the jackpot. And when my agent told me, she was like, well, how much would be our bottom offer deal? And I was, I'll do it for free. And she was, don't tell them that. I will do the negotiating. Keep your mouth shut. And I was like, yeah, that's probably for the best.
To be even selected, did they explain to you, or maybe you might be left in the dark, but did they explain to you how they came across your work in the first place and how they were like, okay, Beth Revis is the perfect person to write this book?
I am super curious about it, but I'm also super terrified to ask. Oh. I keep waiting for them to be like, oh, just kidding, we met another Beth Revis, not you. So I just show up and I'm here, I am ready to do the work. Don't look too closely at me. I promise I'm good. So, I've been too terrified to ask.
You know what? Obviously, they're huge fans of all your books.
Or it was a total accident. And there was some other Beth Revis in the world who was supposed to get this.
Well, let me tell you, when we Google Beth Revis, you're the only one popping up everywhere left and right. So I don't think so. It's definitely you. And I'm telling you, they fell in love with your work. You worked your ass off for so long. And I mean, you're killing it, especially that sci-fi world. I don't think they could have picked a more perfect person. That's awesome. And I think that's so exciting. I'm so freaking excited for you. So I'm assuming that's something that you're most excited about right now.
Right now, I'm very, very excited about it. It comes out in May, just in time for an epic May the 4th party. Nice. And so that's got my focus right now. And then I'm also really, really excited about the thing that's coming out next.
Yes,
it's the first
book.
Fantasy.
Yes.
And all the 10 novels that I had wrote that were rejected, they were all fantasy. So this is the first fantasy that's actually going to make it and get published.
Congratulations. I'm so excited for you. Can't leak too much information right now, right?
Well, I can say that it's about a necromancer, a girl who can raise people from the dead, and the boy who was sent to kill her.
That sounds really freaking good. You're just teasing the listeners now. They're just like,
no,
what,
I
girl?
Am.
And that's coming out 2018?
Yes. Yes.
We'll just hold our breath for a year. Thank you so much. We'll try not to die while waiting. That's so exciting. I met you through Quarterly, which we are super excited to collaborate with. I love the work that they're doing, and I love that they're very selective about the curator. How did that come about? Do you mind if I hear that process? Because I am genuinely curious about how they approached you, if you knew about them already. How did that whole thing work out?
I was lucky enough to be their first YA literary box.
Wow. Talk about raising the bar. Thanks a lot.
I don't know how they picked me. This is another one that I don't look at too closely because I'm terrified that they actually meant somebody else. There's another Beth Revis out there in the world who's like, damn it, why don't I ever get any luck? Because I'm stealing it all from you. I loved it. I loved how caring they were. I've talked to other people who have been in other subscription boxes and they're like, yeah, they just told me they picked my book and that's the last I heard of it. And that was not the case with Quarterly. Quarterly was hugely hands-on. I was able to pick out everything that came in the box and they helped me find things that were even better. I would have a vague idea and they're like, okay, well, what about this? I'm like, no, that's what I really wanted. I just didn't know it. We were able to select the other books that go with it, which was so much fun, but also hugely stress-inducing because I was like, I want all the books in the box. My favorite part about it was that we got to write on little post-it notes and put our own behind-the-scenes glimpses or explainings in the actual book. So it felt like I could actually be with the reader and be like,
yes,
see that scene? That's an allusion to Doctor Who. Or, oh, this happened because this happened in my real life. That was the most fun part. And of all the books, I was so glad that it was A World Without You that I got to do that with.
Oh my God, I'm so excited because, you know, when you're talking about book tours, how as much as we all love sitting at home in our underwear, but don't worry, I have my pajama pants on right now. I am not talking to you, butt naked with
nobody gets to see us. It's a podcast.
I know, right? But you know, talking about like how book tours are, where you love that process when you actually get to talk to the readers, and that's a different feeling. That's the thing that caught my eye about Quarterly, was that they mentioned that the books come with annotations from the curator throughout the book. And I think for me, that's what I love about this podcast, is that I get to hear your stories behind the scenes and your thought process and all of that. But having it boiled down to post-it notes throughout, and it's so specific in seeing exactly which sentence, which paragraph, which chapter, which page actually relates to something in your life, or like you had a funny thought. That's truly what caught my attention about Quarterly, aside from it being carefully selected curators as well. This is what Quarterly told me, that the authors get to choose 2 books at maximum to come with your book. How do you select those books?
I didn't end up picking ones that had inspired me, but I picked ones that I thought, if you like my book, you'll also like this one. Ones that kind of touched me in the same way that I was trying to touch people with A World Without You. The two that I picked was Bell Jar, which is about a girl who is also at a school for mentally disturbed youth. It has a totally different plot, but that same thread existed. And then another one called The End or Something Like It by Andy Ellis. And that one, it was a very funny story, but it's also about death and that sort of juxtaposition between hilariously laughing and then, oops, that person really did die. I thought that was a good balance for the box, but that was what I was trying to think of with the box. It was like, what would make this balance? What would go on the shelf beside these books?
Man, that must have been super tough. So I know you mentioned just right before that it was hard to narrow it down. Were there any other things that you included in your box?
I don't think it's a spoiler anymore because it's been out for a bit. But the thing that I really loved that I was able to include is a string photo holder. It's like a big red string with clips in it that you can put pictures on. And that was really, really important and tied in with my book. If you look at the cover, the book is covered in strings. And that's because Bo, my main character, feels like he's connected to people through strings. And so I was able to put the string photo holder with it. And it was just a perfect complement to the book.
I saw the screenshot of your box in Quarterly's website. You were one of the first ones popping up, of course. I noticed there was a card too. What did that card have? What was that? Why did you choose that card?
The card has Emily Dickinson on it. And one of the titles I was thinking of for A World Without You was originally going to be Wider Than the Sky, because Emily Dickinson has a poem where she mentions that the mind is wider than the sky. And I've always loved Emily Dickinson. I love the way that she thinks. She has a beautiful voice. And so there was that, but then we made it into a card because part of the other aspect of A World Without You is having the courage to speak up and talk to people about these hard issues. And so I gave a challenge to the readers of the Quarterly box to use that card to write to somebody that they need to speak to.
Talk about putting it in their hands and making them proactive. That is awesome. Overall, you felt it was an exciting experience, or tell us honestly how you felt about it.
It was exciting, but it was also very introspective. Mm-hmm. And it really made me think about not just the book, but the experience of reading the book that other people may have. And I loved that the annotations really felt I was talking to the reader as they went. When I was reading the book, looking for places to annotate, I was like, what would I want to tell a friend if they were reading my book? What would I want to hang over their shoulder? And that just made me feel so close to the reader in a way that is almost indescribable.
Again, that's what caught my attention. Have you heard directly from any readers who got a box?
Yeah, I've had a few people email me, and some of them, they've really appreciated the other books that were in the box. Some of them used a photo holder and they have pictures on their walls of the photo holder hanging and showing how they use that. I haven't heard from anybody who used a card yet, so I'm still waiting on that one.
Okay, maybe I'll be the first one. Thank you so much for walking us through that. When I do bring on people to collaborate with, it's important that I know that it would really touch the listeners in some way that's very either their hearts or is super helpful to their writing journey as well. I'm very excited about this. And Beth, you've been awesome. Could we wrap it up with three rapid fire questions? So I'll just shoot out these questions and you tell me whatever's in your head and we'll go, okay? First one, tips on query letters.
Oh, I was expecting something totally different. Tips on query letters. Query in batches. And so you pick out your top five and send it to them and see what they respond with. And if you just get form rejections, that means you need to rewrite your query. And if they accept the query and sample pages, but then reject it, that means you need to rewrite your opening. So query in batches and see what the response are.
Love that. All right. Second one. Money. Tips on earning income while you're trying to survive as an artist/writer.
My parents would say have a good college degree and a salary job, and that there's definitely something to be had for that. I think also not being afraid to ask for help if you need to it, and don't be too proud to do work that you may not normally do as long as it helps you towards your goals. And there's also a really good system of bartering. So if you can't pay for somebody to help critique your work, offer to swap manuscripts with them or something like that.
Agree 100%. Third one, what are small manageable steps you would advise writers to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goals?
Go out and have a new adventure. I think the classic answer to this would be like write every day, but that was bullshit. It never worked for me. But what does work is to go out and something fun to do and do a new experience. And the more new experiences you have, the more stories you'll have to tell.
All right. And the final wrap up of this interview is, what is a book or a few books? I know we mentioned quite a few up at the top. We were talking about J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter. We're talking about The Chronicles of Narnia. Are there any other books that you love to share with our readers that you think that they can benefit from? And also, of course, you recommended those books in your quarterly box too, but anything outside of that?
A book that is just beautiful on a craft level would be Nova Rensuma's Imaginary Girls. And I think if you like A World Without You, you'll also like that one. And it is a beautiful, stunning story, but just on a prose level, on a word-by-word level, Nova Rensuma is just a master of the craft. For a fun science fiction romp, I just recently finished reading Ryan Groudon's Invictus, which is sort of if Doctor Who meets Firefly. So if you're into the sci-fi elements, definitely check that one out. And for a fantasy story, read Lauren DiStefano's The Glass Spare. It's a beautiful, beautiful story about a girl who is cursed.
Ooh, that sounds good. Beth, you have been so awesome.
Thanks, you as well.
And that wraps up our episode with the amazing Beth Revis. Beth, I loved our chat and had such a great time with you. Storytellers, I'm so grateful for your support and thank you for listening in and joining us as always. Please say hi to Beth on Twitter at Beth Revis. Beth recommended an amazing list of really helpful resources for you to check out, and we have them all linked up in our show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Beth Revis. I really hope you enjoyed hearing about Beth's behind-the-scenes curation process for Quarterly's very first YA fiction subscription box. So every 3 months, Quarterly works with a new author to put together a box that's themed around their brand new release. They work with authors that range from highly acclaimed new voices to veteran bestsellers. Like Beth mentioned earlier in our interview, each Quarterly box includes 3 books, the brand new release in hardcover by Quarterly's guest curator, and 2 more books that the author finds a personal connection with. In Beth's box, she included items that she put a lot of thought into choosing. A string photo holder, which was directly connected to her book's message, and it also connected to her book cover, and Beth included a postcard to encourage readers to write to someone in their personal lives that they need to speak to about difficult issues. For this quarter's brand new young adult fiction curator, Quarterly is excited to feature author Rory Harrison and Rory's debut novel, Looking for Group. The other 2 carefully selected books and bookish goods that come in Rory's box are being kept a surprise. As a hint, past curators have also included goodies like bookmarks, tea, socks, and mugs. Quarterly has a Goodreads book club where readers can connect with the author through AMAs, read-alongs, and find exclusive content from the author. As you all know by now, my favorite part about the subscription is that the author actually annotates their new release. Like we talked about in Beth's interview, Quarterly curators include post-it notes throughout their entire book, and those post-its are packed with fun facts, tidbits, deleted scenes, and real-life inspiration. I'm so excited for you to dive into Rory Harrison's Quarterly box to read through the annotations for yourself, and I couldn't be more pleased to announce that Quarterly created an exclusive special just for our 88 Cups of Tea community, where you'll receive $8 off your subscription box by entering promo code 88cups at checkout. Be sure to enter 88 Cups as one word. Head over to quarterly.com/88cupsoftea to get your box. Our tribe's exclusive promo code is valid until April 21st, so be sure to get your box before then so you can use the promo code for yourself. I can't wait to hear your thoughts about your Quarterly box.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.